the suggested topics for papers. Yeah. I should perhaps say a couple of things. You don't have to take one of these. If, as we go along, there is some idea that occurs to you that you'd like to look into a little bit more, why take that one? Tell me, and maybe I can help you to narrow it down or expand it or something. These are just suggestions, but they are suggestions. I think they would be all right. I have put in here sometimes some references. Number 4, crimes of violence, C-A-N-E-T. Of course, you know that means ancient Near Eastern text. And there you have the complete Code of Hammurabi. In the first part, the first one, a consideration of driver's list of late words in the P document, I-L-O-T, Introduction to the Literature of the Old Testament. That was a very, basic work. Very influential work in the early days of this century. Driver wrote very convincingly, and you know Driver was one of the authors of Brown Driver Briggs, and he was also one of the editors of the International Critical Commentary, which all the preachers of America would get, and it was full of unbelief, you know. Driver was, this book of his was back of a great deal of the wide acceptance of the higher critical view in those years. And he had a list of the P document words, and I've cited a number of them, which deal with particular vocabulary here, 2, 3, 8, 6, 6, 8, 9, so on. And some of these are used also in Ugaritic when Daniel and Driver thought they were late words, characteristic of the P document. Now, Driver, very carefully, he covered all his bases. He wouldn't say necessarily that a word was late, but that it was more used in late times. There are some early traces in the P documents, you see. So it was kind of elastic. You could have it and eat, have your cake and eat it too. There were some traces of early material, and if an Orthodox person would find some early material in the P document, oh yes, that would be one of the early things in the P document, you know. But then there were these late things in the P document. And one of them that I've cited already is the use of the word ani. Now, he admitted that the ani Adonai, I am the Lord, that this phrase is used early. But the preponderance of use of the ani, you know, would be late. So to find a word in Ugaritic that he said was late, just one may be not sufficient to answer all of his questions, but I think it is usually admitted now that so those late words, many of those late words were not. I think I mentioned Lauren Fisher. Not sure I gave you the full title. Lauren Fisher has a book called Parallels, Rosh Hamra Parallels in the Old Testament. There are several volumes. I have the first volume. I think there are 1, 2, and 3. Of large volumes where you have words, especially in the Psalms, which are in pairs in the Hebrew and also in the Ugaritic. And when you get a lot of these, it gets pretty impressive. And Driver's ideas are not really accepted anymore. But some of you would like to look up that Ugaritic usage, it might be interesting. Now, somebody asked me, could you handle the Ugaritic? Have any of you had courses in Ugaritic? I guess not. But let me tell you, it's not all that abstruse. You could handle Ugaritic. The Ugaritic language is very close to Hebrew. Now, of course, it's the ancient Hebrew, and there are some things that you would not be familiar with. But it is the same structure. You have the same type of words, nouns and verbs, and stems, the different stems. The alphabet is the same as the Hebrew alphabet, except it's not written in the familiar alphabet that we have. They used cuneiform signs on clay tablets, and these were not the cuneiform language signs. This was a set of signs, just like a Morse code, that they invented for the alphabet. And you can learn them without much trouble. I've learned them several times. I think it was Mark Twain says it's easy to give up smoking. He'd done it 100 times. So, you know, learn them and forget them. But they're available. Mostly, helpfully, the Ugaritic language is cited in the Latin letters. It's transcription. And you can handle that, although you're perhaps not used to reading Hebrew. To read it like this, you know, K-B-B, Yod. But, of course, you can do it that way just as well. And so you can use Hebrew in transcription. And the Ugaritic is usually given in transcription. And in Kerler Baumgartner, when a word is cited in Ugaritic, it just says U-G. We were looking up with somebody the word Hamor. Hamor. Homer. Homer. It says U-G-F-M-R. Of course, the Ugaritic doesn't have vowels. And so the Ugaritic, you can profit by that from Kerler Baumgartner. The Ugaritic material is translated in A-N-E-T, a good bit of it. Not all. It is translated there, and Cyrus Gordon, who is, I think, still living, a Semitist, used to teach at Dropsy College here in this city, and also Brown University, and has done a lot of work in Ugaritic. He has a grammar of Ugaritic. Well, it's a three-part work. First part is grammar, and another part is the texts in transliteration, and another part is a lexicon. So his lexicon is where you would conveniently go to check on a word like Khmer. You look it up under Khmer and you'd find it in the lexicon, Gordon's lexicon. I'm sure that's in the library. There is another lexicon that is said to be better, and I guess it is, Eisleitner, I guess, first one. And it is called, Ugaritische Sprache. It's a dictionary of the Ugaritic language, and it is in German. But it has the entries, I think it has the entries in Hebrew letters, then followed by transcription. So Eisleitner you should at least know about, and I imagine it's in the library too. You could use it, but it wouldn't be quite as easy as to use Gordon's. So you should know that material. And of course the value of Ugaritic is just tremendous. Here is material that was written, and we have the copies coming from the days of Moses. And it's rather extensive. It is mostly religious poetry. The wars of Baal and Anat. Some of it kind of gory. And there's a tale of Daniel and some other religious poetry pieces. So it's particularly valuable for poetic Old Testament. Psalms, Job, and places like that. But it gives you a number of things, of course, very important things, Hebrew grammar and so on. But my point is, don't be scared of Ugaritic. You could use it to some purposes without too much trouble. The way I put it is that the easy Ugaritic you could all read, and the hard Ugaritic nobody can read. So don't be afraid of it. The sacrifices in Leviticus and in Ugaritic. And I've suggested a couple of books there, Albright, Yahweh and the Gods of Canaan, where he just directly makes those comparisons. That's a very interesting and good book. It's one of the later books of Albright. Marvin Pope wrote the Anchor Bible on Job, the A.B., the Anchor Bible on Job. And he's written another, I think it's Ale in the Ugaritic Text, or some similar expression, Ale in the Ugaritic Text, that there would be a study of the gods of Ugarit. So those things are available, though it would take a little digging to do that first and third topic, I suppose. Some of the rest, abbreviation, I guess, is obvious. 6, that Wenham is a new international commentary on the Old Testament, and Harrison in the InterVarsity. Harrison deals negatively with Mary Douglas's laws, and we'll discuss them in due time. Harrison discusses it negatively and briefly. Wenham discusses them positively and extensively. And I take in my commentary on Leviticus and the Expositor's Biblical Bible Commentary Series, EBC, I go into Mary Douglas's material more at length and very much opposed to it. Any other questions on the this comparison, number 8, comparison of architecture in tabernacle and chapel and tomb of King Tut? I have a picture of that at home. I didn't get it out, but if anybody is interested in that particular item, I guess that would be more on Exodus than Leviticus, but Leviticus, after all, does deal with the tabernacle, so it would be legitimate, I guess. Yes?
In number 6, mm-hmm. Gordon Lennon?
Yes, I think it's Gordon Lennon. Anything else? Look them over, and you don't have to decide right away. Of course, don't put it off too long, and as I said before, you don't need to limit yourself to these topics if you come to some item that you would like to look into a little bit more and do a paper on. And the paper, somebody asked me how long it should be. I don't know. If you can do it in 10 pages, why not help me? Not too long. On the other hand, I would want you to spend a fair amount of work on it. So, well, you may have other questions as we go along. I think we should spend... Well, maybe we better not spend any more time in the Hebrew. I will hold you for the rest of the Hebrew. Let me ask this. In the rest of the reading here, do you have any questions? The material that we haven't covered in class. We may not cover it in class next time. Yes?
Did you tell us why they were supposed to put the hand on the head?
No, I didn't. I didn't. Why do you think? I don't think they patted it. I don't think it was that.
Identification? I think it's a symbolic question.
The question is, why was the offerer to put his hand on the head of the animal? It's done again and again, isn't it?
Right.
It was the usual practice.
Was it a symbolic transfer of sin or something like that?
Symbolic transfer of sin? How do you like that? Most likely. Well, we haven't got to it yet, but in Leviticus 16, the great day of atonement, there it says, same thing, you put your hand on the head of the animal, and it says, thus putting the sins of Israel on the sacrifice. So that specifically says transfer of guilt. Identification with transfer of guilt, and it is interesting that it is said for all these sacrifices, but is not explained until the very solemn Day of Atonement ceremony, where the priest, the high priest, puts his hands on the head of the animal, thus transferring, it says, the sins of the nation, because he was taking the place of, and symbolically, of the nation, and putting the sins of the nation on the sacrifice in that great annual humiliation day. Good. Other questions? Yes.
Did you mention the significance of the Sabbath when you were discussing the against the altar, on the altar, and then the arrest?
Well, yes, I said it, but I said that I don't know that it would decide the question, because whether you put it on the fire here, or you'd have to walk around if you did it on the sides, but you could walk around if you put it on the fire, too. You wouldn't reach out and put it in the middle of that fire. You'd put it in different parts of the fire. And it might be left in general, because it might be that you just put it on where the fire was burning. Pretty hot.
But the transfer of sin, mm-hmm. I know Leon Morris made an issue over expiation and propitiation. Expiation used in the Old Testament versus propitiation in the New Testament. This laying on of hands, how do you see that theologically?
I don't make that distinction that he makes between propitiation. course, that's a distinction in English terms, English terminology. I would say those terms overlap some. But aside from the English terminology, the point is, it's substitution. It's substitution. My sins go on the sacrifice and I am free. And this is atonement. And that is the teaching of Old Testament and New Testament both. Because the New Testament makes specific verbal parallel here, because this is done on the great day of atonement. This is done for the animal that is carried, whose blood is carried into the mercy seat. And the mercy seat is the kaporet, the Hebrew kaporet, which in Greek is hilasterion in the Septuagint. And the New Testament says Christ is our hilasterion. So there's the verbal parallel there of the sacrifice of the Day of Atonement, and it is a substitution. Whether you express it, now the NIV did not express it in propitiation. We didn't use the word. And we were objected to because of that. But we did say the thing. And we said it become a sacrifice of atonement because we kept the word atonement in the New Testament the same as you have it in the Old Testament. Just as the hilasterion is both. So identifying it through the word atonement was what we did, which I still think is better. Propitiation becomes a technical thing that, of course, you can say you expiate, pay the prices for expiation. Propitiation, you can use both of them, you know, in the sense of making somebody favorable one way or another, under the table or some special favor.
You see it more synonymous.
Yes, I do.
Is there any difference between going sending it out, the animal and they going into the wilderness, and here we have laying on the hands?
Yeah. Well, the Day of Atonement, we will translate that when we come to it. I think it is a beautiful picture there in chapter 16 of Leviticus, because you have two animals, and one of them pays the price, and the other one takes it away. That's a wonderful thing to have both.
So we come. Lacking here. Is there
I don't think there's anything lacking here. The emphasis here, yes, the emphasis here is on atonement, because the animal must be killed. The animal dies. And the theory of Leviticus is that the blood is life, and the life is given, and that the benefit of that death is for the worshiper, who identifies with this laying on of hands. So the laying on of hands, I think, is very significant. Now, the one thing I'd mention by the side, we have here all this ritual. I saw the Samaritan Passover one time over in Samaria, in Nablus. And one thing impressed me that really surprised me. I'd never thought of it. They had the motions of the Passover. They killed the lamb, they had the blood, they scattered it, put it on the wall, the doorpost of their tents, and they had them roasted and all that. But what surprised me was it was all accompanied with prayer and chanting. And here you have instructions for how to do it, but you don't have any of the liturgy. And I can't imagine that these things were done without prayer and probably singing in psalms. So the liturgy is to be understood. We can't identify it, but we must not think that they just went through motions up here. This was a sacrament. This was a religious service. And it was done in the name of the God of Israel. And that's to be understood as a background. And to find, we don't know that we can't find it, we can't reproduce it. We can say it will be like the psalm, the later psalm, in some way. Well, I think maybe we had better stop there. And for next time, maybe I won't give quite as much for next time. I want you to take the guilt offering next time. I'll give you the verses in the English. I think they're the same in the Hebrew. I haven't checked them. In Leviticus 6:14, the guilt offering. Now, it goes down through the whole of chapter, well, part of 6. It's 5:14 to begin, thank you. 5:14 to begin, and go through 6, I think perhaps just the bottom of that page in English, through 6:7. 5:14 through 6:7. Okay? That's much less Hebrew. If you didn't finish it for today, well, you can go back a little bit. Now, that passage brings up this whole question of the things that are done unintentionally. There are some people that say that unintentional sins can be forgiven. And you offer a sacrifice for unintentional sins. But on the contrary, they say intentional sins cannot be forgiven. Now, that's a little difficult. There's an awful lot of sins that we do on purpose. I think Dr. Elmer Schmick at Gordon Seminary, he has a story about a fellow who knocked somebody down and they got him for it. And I said, well, why did you knock him down? Well, that was the devil in me. Well, why did you kick him when he was down? Well, that was the devil in me. Well, why did you put your thumb in his eye? Well, Judge, he says, that was my idea. So, there are sins we do intentionally. And pretty hard for me to feel that these were. But that's a problem. So think of that as you translate some of these things. I think I have it on one of the passages in one of these questions to compare the passage over in Numbers, number 14. I give you the passage in Numbers 15:30 that bears on the question there. But think of that as you do that exercise for next time. Okay. Now, to go back then to lecture for a little while. We said the position of Leviticus in the Pentateuch, its relation to the building of the tabernacle. I showed how in Exodus you have the tabernacle was to be built in the imperative and it was built in the perfect. And this is where then the tabernacle was finished in the end of Exodus. Then I said that the priesthood, relation to establishing the priesthood, Moses not only built the tabernacle, but also he arranged for its use. And that you have in Exodus, you have the imperative of consecrating the priests, and in the perfect, you have that fulfilled in Leviticus. So here you have this tie-in between Exodus and Leviticus. I said that last time, I believe, to show the relationship of Exodus 29 to Leviticus. It goes right along. It's one continued story. 5 books of the Pentateuch, but that was probably for practical reasons, as we said. And its relation to other legislation in Exodus 21-23, that's the so-called Book of the Covenant, and Deuteronomy 12-26, the center of the Book of Deuteronomy, has all these different laws, many of which are similar to laws in Leviticus and in Exodus. And there are even laws of the 5 feasts that you have in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So the relation to other legislation, you have some passages in Leviticus. Indeed, chapter 11 of Leviticus is almost word for word with a part of Deuteronomy 14. Those are the laws of cleanliness, the clean foods. The clean foods are the same. But there are other passages in Deuteronomy. Now, one might wonder, I suppose, why these things would be given twice. Does that mean 2 authors? Some people think so. the other hand, Deuteronomy, a second law, it's not a bad idea to reiterate some things. I'm sure none of you have ever preached the same sermon twice. Things must be reiterated in different contexts, also in different times. After all, you've got a lot of reiteration between Samuel Kings and Chronicles, don't you? Samuel Kings and Chronicles deals with similar material, but from a different angle, and for somewhat different purposes. You've got synoptic gospels. There's nothing wrong for a thing to be given more than once, so that we have references for other purposes in other connections and context is not at all unlikely in heaven. Critical views in Leviticus and its place in the Pentateuch. The historic views, I think we said something about that. And the JEDP theory, and the theory was that J was around 850, and that E was around 750. And the Deuteronomy was in 620, the time of Josiah. And the P document was 450 B.C. Well, this neat division is not held in modern times, although it is remarkable how much of that does still exist in Genesis. Of course, this is talking about the whole Pentateuch, but in Genesis, in the Anchor Bible, written by Dr. Spicer, whom I took a lot of material under pen, in Genesis, the Anchor Bible, the divisions into J, E, and P are not much different from the old line driver material of 50 years before. So the JEDP hypothesis is not dead. Some of the reasons are changed, and they're not quite so sure about the details. The J document is put at 950 instead of 850. Hooray. Big deal. But there's a lot of similarity to the JEDP theory still, even in modern times. But each man thinks he's got a better idea on a few verses here and a few verses there. I think the big difference, I said this before, I think the big difference is Martin Note, and he has influenced a lot of people. And he has a rather extensive view. And his view is in Genesis you have it just about like the older views. He wasn't concerned so much with that. Has a J, E, and P. But then, this was true for Genesis to Numbers, and this has been called now the Tetrateuch. You see, before, the usual critics spoke of the Pentateuchal division. But then they got real sharp. And if you divide Genesis on these principles, you can also divide Joshua. And if you divide Joshua, you can also divide Judges. And so the critics used to speak of Pentateuch, and then they talked of the Hexateuch. And the Hexateuch, they had seven books that they could divide into J, E, D, and P. Well, Driver is very much opposed to that. He doesn't find any J, E, and D, J, E, and P, in Joshua and Judges. Instead, he speaks of the Tetrateuch, Genesis to Numbers, and then from there on, you have the Deuteronomist, D-E-R, he puts it, the Deuteronomist. Deuteronomist has Deuteronomy, plus Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and 1st and 2nd Kings. Deuteronomist does all that. Well, then the P document, according to him, is the outline of the Tetrateuch. J was there and E was there, but these old traditions were used by the P author or school. And the P author school wrote the tetratube using J and E, see? So the outline of it is due to P. The first chapter, Genesis 1, is due to P. And the last chapter, which is Death of Moses, is due to P. Most of Deuteronomy is not, but the last two or three verses, the last two or three chapters of Deuteronomy, that is P. And so P, author, was interested in Sinai, and his story was concluded with the death of Aaron and the death of Moses. So so the tetratube here would be the work of P, who had used the ancient authors, the older traditions of J and E. Now, it's a trick to see how this system that had four books suddenly got Deuteronomy in there when it belongs to what follows. And he does it in a very neat way. He says that the old system, the old views, the J and E included the conquest theme. He goes by theme very strongly. The conquest theme. But the P author was not interested in the conquest theme. He was just interested in Sinai and the death of Aaron and Moses. And the Deuteronomist was interested in the conquest theme, and he had it in Joshua. So the Deuteronomist prepares the way for the conquest. You find that in the book of Deuteronomy. And the Transjordan conquest is in the book of Deuteronomy. And so the Deuteronomist has all this. But the old conquest theme of the J and P, J and E, he says that was just dropped because P didn't want it. And this is how you get the Deuteronomist in there into the Pentateuch. Follow him there is a little bit difficult, and of course I think it's impossible to see how you get the Deuteronomist who is interested in the conquest and get it inserted into or added to a P document that is not interested in the conquest, and you end up, instead of four books, you end up with a fifth book that is taken away from its major part and put into a different book. How do you get the Pentateuch out of the Tetrateuch is, I think, one of the things that Note just doesn't answer satisfactorily. Of course, he tries to. I don't think we'll take the time. It's given in this book that I had last time. This is the Chronicler's History. Interested in that, it would be on page 139. The larger literary whole, which resulted from the inclusion of the older sources within the framework of P, and which we now have in the books of Genesis to Deuteronomy, quite naturally came to be coextensive with the P narrative and thus concluded with the death of Moses. That is how the Pentateuch came into being. But he can say it, but I just don't see how the Pentateuch came into being by taking off of the old sources the conquest theme. The P document didn't have the conquest theme, and somehow Deuteronomy, that did have the conquest theme, got separated from its material and put over into the P document. And the only way they did it was to put on three chapters about the death of Moses toward the end. So this is Note, and then he has to take all of the book from Deuteronomy to 2 Kings is the work of this man who he calls him the Deuteronomist. And my approach to Note and to the other critics would be that although he ascribes this material to the Deuteronomist, and the other to the P document, he has no evidence for it at all. Here is the conquest narrative. Now, the conquest narrative has in it some old material, but then it has some later material. And this looks like old material, and this looks like late material. Then you go on to Joshua. And Joshua, the lists in Joshua look as if they come from the days of the monarchy. And some is old and some is late. But as you read through, it is all, this looks to me as if it's late. This looks to me as if it's early. My criticism is the whole thing is as subjective as can be. Driver at least said, here are late languages, here are late words. He was wrong, but at least he had some criterion. And he says that the theme of conquest, the theme of Sinai, the theme of the Exodus, he builds on these big themes. But he just has a most subjective approach to verses that may be late. I was looking for it, didn't see it. There is a page that has someplace that shows the material in the Deuteronomy. And there are some verses up here, and then there's some verses down here, and some verses up here, and it gives a number of things that are early and some that are late, and this is a very picture is as confusing as can be. Now, to try to answer each particular verse is, I suppose, possible, but it would take forever. And the general approach to me is that it is subjective as can be. And the subjective argument, I must admit, the subjective argument is hard to answer. If it looks early to Note, well, he says it's early. Okay, it looks late to me. It looks late to me. Who can tell me the otherwise? I like blue, so I like blue. Somebody else likes brown. There's no definite argument at all. You cannot say that there are these particular items in the book of Leviticus that are late. You can say things in the book of Leviticus that you think are late, but you don't find, you don't turn up any documents that say there was no sacrifice in ancient Israel.